Donald Trump picks Indiana Governor Mike Pence as his running mate. Will the choice of a Midwesterner help him win Iowa's electoral votes? It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll talk first with Dennis Goldford of Drake University about Trump's VP pick and next week's GOP convention. Then a conversation with Iowa GOP Chair Jeff Kaufman. After that, how students at the University of Iowa will pick their personal pronouns, the Polk County Sheriff's Office investigation of a Twitter conversation that involves one of its jailers, and the beef behind Des Moines' taco truck controversy. Buckle up for your News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our News Buzz to finish off the week, several conversations coming up. But first of all, let's start the hour off with some political analysis of some of the week's events. Joining us to do that, Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of political science at Drake University, also Flansburg Fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement. Hello again, Dennis.
Hi, Ben. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us. Well, this horrific attack in France, let's have you comment on that. Only a few hours old, many unanswered questions we're getting answers to slowly as the investigation ramps up. Not, of course, to ignore the human tragedy here, which is great. But Dennis, given what we know, how does this impact our politics here in North America?
Well, we've got one of those on the one hand and on the other hand. On the one hand, people can decide that in situations like this, and to my last check, there's no official designation of responsibility for this particular attack. On the one hand, it suggests that we need a strong, steady hand on the tiller, and the Hillary Clinton people want to capitalize on that idea. On the other hand, however, just that sense of danger. Remember, the purpose of terrorism is to make you feel unsafe in your own everyday environment. You know, with wartime, if you think, well, somebody's on the front lines, but we're not, we're safe back here. The idea of terrorism is to make sure there is no safe back here anywhere. And that's the kind of legitimate fear people have. It could be overdrawn, it could be underdrawn, but that's the kind of fear on which Donald Trump plays.
Mm-hmm. Donald Trump was to make a live announcement this morning concerning his running mate. He did it rather by tweeting today, Indiana Governor Mike Pence as his running mate. What do you think of Trump's choice of Pence? I guess unlike Newt Gingrich or Chris Christie, this is someone who has, compared to those two, at least relatively little national exposure.
Well, that's true. But I would preface this by saying that, you know, while I'm certainly not a media basher, I think the vice presidential choice is always this media feeding frenzy. Political reporters who are ordinarily very responsible turn into the political version of paparazzi. 48 hours or even 24 hours after the choice is officially made, nobody will pay any attention to it. The vice presidential choice is important constitutionally because there is the literal heartbeat away from the presidency on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, people tend to make too much of the electoral impact or the campaign impact of a vice presidential choice, with the exception of Lyndon Johnson in 1960, who really did win some southern states for JFK. Political scientists generally agree that there is no evidence of any significance that suggests that a particular vice presidential nominee enabled a presidential nominee to win a state he wouldn't have won on his own anyway. So it's not that Pence will win Indiana for Trump. Indiana is always Republican, except in 2008 when it happened to go for Obama.
But does
offer for him, though, is that he has congressional experience and he knows the folks in the Republican leadership in Congress.
Okay, so given that Iowa is a swing state in the Midwest, picking a Midwesterner from a neighboring state doesn't necessarily help Trump. Was that perhaps part of the calculation in the Trump campaign?
Well, you know, again, people vote for the top of the ticket. And I think actually this helps Pence a lot more than it helps Trump. Pence has presidential ambitions. He's extremely, extremely conservative. He's sort of Bob Vanderplatz conservative in terms of, you know, he says he's a Christian first, a conservative second, a Republican third. That's music to the ears of Christian conservatives. But they're already supporting Trump at a higher ratio than they were supporting Mitt Romney. It's going to, you know, on the one hand, people might say it's going to reassure people about Trump, but Trump is so mercurial that you never know. Pence has helped because it gets him out of a tough reelection bid for governor in Indiana, which if he lost would severely damage his presidential prospects. And if he wins, great with Trump. If the Trump ticket goes down, nobody's going to blame Pence.
In the coming days, Hillary Clinton will announce her vice president pick. I guess this puts the Democrats in an advantage, being able to go second. Could Trump's vice presidential pick sway her? I'm just asking sort of as an insider, as in someone who understands political campaigns. Now that he has announced, does this sway her to choose someone on her short list over another?
It might, because unless Pence changes his spots, he's not the kind of political attack dog, which is usually the role of a vice president in a campaign, that, say, Chris Christie or Newt Gingrich would be. He's much more quiet and cautious. Now, maybe he can do the attack dog role. But in that sense, Clinton can perhaps look at somebody who's a lot more substantive than she might have otherwise. But at this point, it's anybody's guess.
Mm-hmm. Was it an unconventional? I get the feeling it's an unconventional way in which Donald Trump chose Mike Pence here, relying on family quite a bit, actually, rather than more of his campaign staff?
Well, that's always the question for any potential presidential nominee or potential president. From whom does this person get his or her advice? That always matters tremendously. And Trump seems to have a very small circle of people that starts and perhaps in some cases ends with his family. He seems to trust the advice of his sons, his son-in-law, and his daughter.
Mm-hmm. A couple of minutes, please, let's devote to the GOP convention, the national convention starting in Cleveland, July 18th next week. Yesterday, Donald Trump, we heard, had a major victory when delegates overwhelmingly opposed some last-ditch efforts to derail his nomination. This was a measure presented to the 112-member committee by anti-Trump delegates. It was soundly defeated. It would have given the Republican National Convention delegates the ability to vote their conscience, regardless of whether they are bound to a candidate based on the results of their state's primary. So was this the last possible chance the anti-Trump Republicans had to derail Trump?
Well, it most likely is. It's hard to see how really that had a serious chance for success. I mean, it's a victory for Trump, to be sure, but more fundamentally, it's a victory for people, whether they like Trump or not, that say the game had a certain set of rules, and if you've lost the game, you can't retroactively change the rules.
Mm-hmm. What are your broader expectations for this convention? What has your attention?
First of all, if a lot of anti-Trump people go there to protest, and particularly the protest turns violent, that plays precisely into Trump's hands. You know, I don't think we're going to have a Chicago 1968 event at either convention, but you know, you never say never in politics, but I'd be really shocked if it got to that point. But if protesters, anti-Trump protesters, do go overboard with their protests, even short of being violent, that plays into Trump's hands. The question will be whether the convention itself shows indications of a continuing and ineradicable rift within the Republican Party between the people that think Trump simply tarnishes the brand and endangers the party, and others who say, no, this is where the party is nowadays.
Mm-hmm. We have just a few seconds left, but on that note, how much does a successful convention with a sense of party, great party unity, how much does that have to do with a nominee succeeding in November to win the White House?
If memory serves me, in 1988, after the Democratic convention finished, Michael Dukakis led Vice President Bush by 17 points. He lost in November by about 6 points.
Okay, so you're saying not much.
Right.
Okay. There's a lot of days, a lot of weeks before we get to November, and we'll be talking to you again several times before that time. We're so glad to have your expertise. Thank you, Dennis Goldford.
It's always a pleasure, Ben.
Of Drake University. It's River to River. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Ahead of that Republican National Convention next week in Cleveland, Iowa GOP Chairman Jeff Kaufman talked with Morning Edition host Clay Masters about his support for Donald Trump. This was a conversation recorded before Trump's tweet earlier this morning announcing Mike Pence as his running mate. Clay began by asking Kaufman about what happens for the delegates who were chosen to go to the Republican National Convention who have not fallen in line behind presumptive nominee Donald Trump?
I'll try to make this as uncomplicated as possible because it's a really good question.
Yeah.
And I will tell you this right now that our organization committee at the State Central Committee is looking, and I've asked them to look in detail, nothing off the table, at our caucus to convention process. I think it is a bit convoluted. I think there are legitimate criticisms and things we need to take a look at. Probably the easiest way to explain this is how we pick our delegates is in many ways different than the caucuses. The delegates that are actually going, the grand total of 30, are picked in three different ways. There's three of us that are automatic. That's the national committee man, committee woman, and myself. Then there is a group that were elected at the district conventions. And then there was a group that was elected at the state. And what happens there, what generally occurs is that the presidential campaigns got involved in those races, almost as if they were all mini nominating conventions for specifically for delegates, almost as if they were candidates. And what happened is the Cruz ground game kicked in again. And so the Cruz ground game got elected the majority of those delegates. Bottom line is, we got some folks that still want Cruz to be the nominee. That's not going to happen. The overwhelming majority of the Iowa delegation understands that Trump is our nominee. And actually, I'm very pleased right now with those folks that didn't support Donald Trump. The vast majority of those folks are now behind that. But I think what will ultimately happen, because we bind our delegates, because 4 years ago, we had delegates that were going off on their own tangent. And be real frank about it, we made a fool of ourselves in Tampa. We have a new leader as chair of the party, and I wasn't going to let that happen again. We have a few people that either through ignorance or selective memory or just who knows what motivation would be, are questioning that process. Changing those rules now would be the equivalent of in the seventh game of the World Series, two outs, ninth inning, and we want to change how many strikes and balls that you can have.
At the same time, Iowans got a long 2015 to meet a lot of Republican presidential candidates. Many of the voters that I talked to throughout that process were of the mind that they did not want Donald Trump to be the nominee for the Republican Party. Why do you support Donald Trump?
Well, and I would just say in terms of that question, Clay, I talked to a lot of people that didn't want Ted Cruz to be the president, didn't want Marco Rubio to be the president. Don't misconstrue decibel level with numbers, because I know there were folks that were skeptical. Part of that skepticism, though, I got to say, was because Donald Trump was different. I mean, when you have someone different.
Well, he said some very offensive things that have offended people over
the
time frame.
And, you know, and I will say one thing. He did not lie, and we don't have an FBI director saying that he lied. So there were definitely, you know, the is it a tweet or is it, you know, lying during an FBI investigation? I would still argue that we still got a safer candidate in Donald Trump. But the reason that I support Donald Trump is because that's my job. If I was not supporting Donald Trump right now, I need to resign. 4 years ago, we had a Republican chair that did not support the nominee, and he made an utter fool of the state that we all love, regardless of party. But I can tell you now, after having met with Donald Trump, talked with him, I had about a 45-minute discussion with him, I can support Donald Trump on a personal level, not only to prevent four more years or eight more years of Barack Obama, which is what I believe Hillary Clinton would be. I believe what his emphasis on jobs, every politician talks about jobs. We know that. We're now seeing for the first time since 1984, the resurrection of the old phrase, Reagan Democrats. And I know that Democrats don't necessarily want to hear this, but the bottom line is we've got the Trump campaign going into union halls and coming out with a fistful of absentee ballot requests. So I would argue to anyone anyone that for the integrity of our process, if we are really going to say that we are a grassroots party, not only should we unify for all of the reasons that I've been articulating here, we must unify for the integrity of the caucus process in the Republican Party.
Now, you said that you had a pretty lengthy conversation with Donald Trump. How much time do you think he's going to be spending in Iowa? I mean, I imagine that was something you guys talked about.
Well, we certainly did, and a lot. Now, to put this in context, at that point, the nomination was still occurring. And I, by the way, I should tell you, I had really good conversations with most of the 17. But one thing I brought up, obviously, and this is one thing where, you know, you don't see partisanship among the two parties, and that is pressing the first of the nation. And so I'm guessing Andy McGuire had similar conversations like this. But I bring up Iowa. I bring up our caucus system. I bring up why it's important. I bring up why our Iowa citizens on both sides of the aisle are prepared to do this and why we should be doing this. He had some very favorable things to say about Iowa. Now, obviously, he's not going to be negative to the chair, but I think I got a pretty good read after 20 years when somebody's blowing smoke, so to speak, or somebody actually has some affinity for the state. I feel very comfortable with him as our nominee that we have an advocate for first in the nation. He stated so publicly with not a whole lot of wiggle room to back out of that. And at the same time, in my private conversations, if you remember his concession speech to first, at least, after the Iowa caucuses, was a pretty gracious one towards the people of Iowa. And I remember exactly where
he was going to buy a farm, right?
He was going to buy the farm, yeah. And I prefer it would be in eastern Iowa, but, you know, we can go to western Iowa, too. I'm from eastern Iowa. That's the reason I say that. But, no, I think that I feel very comfortable with how Donald Trump feels about Iowa, and I feel comfortable about the type of leader he's going to be outside of the campaign area, where sometimes you have to say provocative things in order to be heard and get people like Clay Masters to get interested in me.
So you're not expecting anything raucous or crazy. You're expecting status quo when the convention takes
place.
When it's all said and done,
I expect status quo, and I expect a more unified party on Friday than what we have in Sunday, and I would say that I believe we're still ahead of schedule with where we're at on the unification now. Just was doing fundraising calls in my office before I came in here. Talked to a person that was not he disclosed to me that Donald Trump wasn't even in his top 10. A very astute business person I was talking to. And I said, well, where are you at on this? I mean, how do you feel? He said, I'm supporting Donald Trump. And I said, why? And I want to understand what's behind the, you know, a lot of Republicans, especially those that are still skeptical, because it's okay to be skeptical. It's okay to wonder about the question marks. And there are question marks on how Donald Trump is going to govern. The point that he was making to me, though, is that the Donald Trump that I know and I'm comfortable with, and I think for instance, his list of Supreme Court nominees was a brilliant move for him, not only in terms for people to understand what makes him tick, but also, you know, his politics. Is he going to be governed from a conservative point of view? I think the few question marks that remain on Donald Trump on some issues, I think they're completely overshadowed by what we know Hillary is going to do. And so I wish she would have been indicted. I believe she needed to have been. But the fact that she didn't, in terms of campaign politics, I don't think it mattered, quite frankly. In fact, in some ways, I think the anger of her not being indicted probably causes more question marks in terms of what she believes, and I think helps to push people more towards Donald Trump. I've heard multiple Democrats tell me that. So I think there's a lot of people where this are at where this gentleman was at when I talked to him today. And that is, he's getting there. He's absolutely positively going to vote for him. As long as he believes that there's not going to be any impact negatively down ticket, and as long as he believes that he's going to follow through with his emphasis, I think people are willing to accept the remaining question marks that are there.
Jeff Kaufman, chairman of the Republican Party of Iowa, thank you.
Thanks, Clay.
Iowa Public Radio's Morning Edition host Clay Masters talking with Iowa GOP Chairman Jeff Kaufman. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River. Well, the buzz this week in the gaming sector is, of course, that Pokemon Go is taking over the country and Iowa. If you've been outside this week, you've probably seen crowds of people staring at their smartphones, playing this game, Pokemon Go. In order to understand the new app a little better, producer Catherine Perkins went out and asked some experts how to play and what's so special about this game.
So tell me about Pokemon Go.
Well, it's this game that you walk around and you find these Pokemons. They'll be everywhere, and you look at the radar, and they'll be just anywhere. And you walk around, and once they get near to you, you can tap on them because they will appear. And then all of a sudden, you'll just see all your surroundings because it will go to like a camera, and you'll just see this little character in front of you that you have to fling a ball at. And a Pokemon ball, and it will suck in. And sometimes they can break free, but most of the time they just stay in.
So tell me, what's the object of the game?
It basically gets people to, like, walk around a lot. Like, we walked over 10,000 steps yesterday, and I was really tired that night.
So tell me, what's the deal with Pokemon? What is a Pokemon, Nathan?
It is a creature that is based on a real creature. And the powerful a Pokemon is, the better it will be in battles.
So the idea is that you capture all these creatures and then they battle?
Yes, basically.
Okay. All right. I guess I get it. Okay. So here we go. You take me. Where are we going?
Well, you go on the radar. And like two.
It tells you what
two
about.
Little paw prints mean that it's 200 feet away. Three means 300 and one means 100, and if there's none, it's right next to you.
What are we going after?
A Pidgey.
What's a Pidgey?
It's a little, like, duckling thing that waddles around. It looks like a baby, like, it looks like a baby duck or, like, a chick, and they have special, like, abilities.
Just a little bit more.
Now we got it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Boom. So we got to throw it at him.
Our Pokeballs missed. You have to aim. You have to aim to be able to hit it.
Oh!
Yay! Let's see if it breaks.
Oh, it'll break free.
What if it breaks free?
What if it freezes?
One, two, three.
We caught him.
It
could not have escaped. It could not have escaped at all.
It was too weak.
Okay, let's keep walking.
Never spawn back in the same place. They're always in different areas. So you can't wait in the same place. Otherwise, like, there can be spawn points, but it's really, really rare to find a spawn point.
So now what are you off to catch?
We're off to catch... Oh, what are we off to catch? That little mouse thing. I forgot what it was called, Nathan. You're the Pokemon expert.
We just heard from Ella Dorman, Kaya Hahn, and Nathan Crone from Marion, who are out playing the new game, Pokemon Go. Coming up on this program on River to River Tuesday, we'll take a look at the economic impact the new game is having in Iowa, and also talk about the personal information you're volunteering to Nintendo when you download the app, Pokemon Go. Coming up after a short break, we'll hear how new and returning students at the University of Iowa will have the opportunity this fall to include their preferred gender pronouns as part of their student record and what a difference that makes. Also, Polk County Sheriff's Office investigation of a Twitter conversation that involves one of its jailers and the beef behind Des Moines taco truck controversy. Your Friday News Buzz continues after this short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It was 3 years ago we reported on it on this program that the University of Iowa became one of the first universities to allow students to identify as transgender on their admissions application, that instead of male or female. Now, the University of Iowa is taking it one step further, allowing students to indicate what pronoun they prefer to be identified with in class. Here to explain it, Jody Lindley, Assistant Professor of Higher Education and Student Affairs at the University of Iowa. Hello, Jody.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Tell us, what is this about? Explain the move that is happening.
Sure. So As you mentioned, the university is moving towards a system where we'll be able to refer to students using their pronouns of reference that they tell us they're using. So this is a part of a larger movement towards taking action that gets our university closer to our actual values for diversity and inclusion. As things currently happen, if a student who identifies as transgender comes to the university, the burden is on that student to reach out to their faculty, their professors, their teaching assistants, their academic advisor, anybody that they're going to interact with. The burden is on the student to contact that person ahead of time or when they first meet that person to let them know, hey, I actually don't use the pronouns that go with this legal name that you see on a piece of paper, or I use a different name than the one that you see in the student record system. Mm-hmm. So we're giving students the agency to be able to tell us from the time that they start at the University of Iowa, this is the name that I use, and these are the pronouns of reference that I use.
Can you give us an example? Because a lot of the people listening, I imagine, don't have a lot of contact with transgender people. So mm-hmm. how would that work in practice?
Yeah, great question. So what that will mean is a couple different things. One, if a transgender student is applying for admission at the University of Iowa, on their admission application, they'll indicate their legal sex, which is usually the sex assigned at birth, and more than likely it's what's on their birth certificate. But then they'll also have the chance to tell us their gender identity. And for folks who are transgender, usually their gender identity doesn't match their legal sex or their sex assigned at birth. So they'll tell us those two things as two separate fields. Then students will have the option to be able to type in the name that they use. This is useful for any student, not just transgender students. So for example, I'm not a good example. My name's Jody. That's short and easy. But if somebody uses a nickname and that's the name that they prefer to be called, mm-hmm. they'll have the option to add that name to their admission application.
Okay. But to the point of the pronouns here, for example,
if I were
transgender, I could say, my name is Ben. Please call me Ben. And then if I didn't want to be referred to as use he, his, or him, what options would I have?
Yeah. So the university is going to have a menu of options that students can select from, and that will include traditional cisgender pronouns, he, him, and his, she, her, and hers. It will also include neutral pronouns like they, them, and theirs, thee, them, theirs. There will be multiple options for students to be able to select from.
Mm-hmm. So there's new parts of our language we have to accommodate instructors and professors, because when you say in this context, they, their, and theirs, we're using that as a singular, aren't
mm-hmm.
we?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct. Yeah. So there's been a national movement to accept they, them, and their, which, of course, traditionally in the English language has been plural, to refer to an individual. And in grammar, you asked, what's this look like in practice? As we're speaking about someone who uses they, them, their pronouns, we still use adverbs and action verbs the way that we would if we're speaking in the plural. So if I'm speaking about an individual who uses they, them, their, I might say they are going to meet us at the student union.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm referring to the individual student who uses they, them, their pronouns.
Right. And as someone who has been an instructor at a university for several years, it's really tough to learn all your students' names at the beginning of the semester. So this adds another layer of I have to say, complication. Is there pushback from any of the professors or instructors here?
So far, no. In fact, I think, in my opinion, most faculty want to create classroom environments that are inclusive, where our students can really bring their whole selves to the classroom and be themselves on day one. So rather than it complicating it for faculty, I think it's going to make it a little easier for us. Mm-hmm. When we download a class list, for example, we will now have each student's legal name, but we'll also have their preferred name. So we'll have access to students' preferred names right away when we have that class list.
Perhaps it's not clear to everyone how important this is, other than, being called by a pronoun or a name that you want to be called by.
Can you give us an example or an idea of the frustration, the awkward situation that a transgender person can get into early on in the semester, I suppose, when this comes up?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it really is. It's about individual respect, but it's also more than that. It's about safety. So if we continued with the systems that are currently in place, a transgender student, perhaps on the first day of class, they show up. If it's a small classroom, more than likely the professor is going to say, you know, is Ben Keeper here? And you'll say, yes, I'm here. And if a student who's transgender is misgendered publicly in front of everyone in the class, that puts that person at risk. So there's the potential for psychological and sometimes even physical danger.
Mm-hmm. One other thing before we say goodbye, Jody Lindley. I understand there's an ongoing project at the University of Iowa where a group of volunteers came together to work on facilities in the campus, on the campus, to audit every single bathroom on campus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is a national debate we had several months ago about transgender people using bathrooms. What is this audit
mm-hmm.
about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's called the Restroom Revolution Project, and it's an opportunity to be able to understand where do we have gender-inclusive restrooms on the University of Iowa campus. So as you mentioned, a group of volunteers came together to do this, to go through every single building on campus, including the hospitals and clinics, and make note of anywhere where there's a single user bathroom or a gender inclusive bathroom. So we now have a map function on our University of Iowa website where anybody who's coming to visit campus, or you know, maybe a prospective student or family member, if they're coming to visit campus and they identify as transgender, they now have access to a map that will show them where are those restrooms that are already gender inclusive. And so they're safe environments for people to be able to use the bathroom without feeling like they have to pick the men's room or the women's room.
I wonder, Jody, is this an intermediate step, what the university can do right now to remedy this situation, or is that the long-term solution?
Related to the restrooms, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. That's a good question. I think that we're taking a big first step. And what I hope to see is that we're moving in a direction where restrooms will simply all become gender inclusive and or single user. So that, you know, I'm a parent, I have little kids, and I always look for that family bathroom if I'm at the mall, if I'm at Adventureland. And I feel like we're moving in a direction where we're getting more towards the concept of universal design, creating facilities that are useful for everyone, that truly are inclusive.
Mm, interesting. Well, thank you very much. Jody Lindley, Assistant Professor of Higher Education and Student Affairs at the University of Iowa, talking about some changes there. We talked about the audit of bathrooms, but also that new and returning students at the University of Iowa will have the opportunity this fall to include their preferred names, but also their gender pronouns as part of their student record. University of Iowa, one of the few universities doing this at this time. Jody Lindley, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me, Ben.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A couple more things to bring you before we close down this Friday edition. A detention officer, a jailer at the Polk County Sheriff's Office, is under investigation after he tweeted to a young woman that she should not call the police if she didn't want to be murdered. Okay. Yes, you heard that right. Brandon Braceland, sergeant at the Polk County Sheriff's Office and public information officer, joins me now by phone to talk about what happened. Sergeant Braceland, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
So what happened? Tell us the context of that statement.
Well, over the weekend, we received several Twitter messages from people actually all over the country, very upset about some posts on Facebook and Twitter from one of our detention officers. I immediately looked into that, seen some screenshots that some individuals had sent me, and we forwarded those to our command staff for review and began an investigation.
Mm-hmm. Here is, if I can quote here, this is from an article in the Des Moines Register, and it concerns your detention officer, Alan Baylock, in conversation with somebody named
Chelsea Vargas, if I have that correct. And at some point in the conversation, he tweets, I believe, I have a simple solution to your problem, Chelsea. If you need the cops, don't call us. That way you don't have to worry about us murdering you because your color solution to your problem. Now, we have to put this in the context. This is a day or so after the shooting of police officers and the terrible week we had with police relations in Minneapolis and also in Louisiana, right?
That's correct. You know, there's no excuse whatsoever to tell any of the people we serve or anybody in the country, for that matter, to discourage them from calling the police in their time of need. This did happen a few days after the Dallas shootings. And what you see there is a portion of the conversation. As of right now, unfortunately, we cannot get the whole conversation of what was said beforehand. But in essence, that doesn't excuse, no matter what it was, would excuse our detention officer from making that statement. Mm-hmm. We recognize that.
If there is no excuse, then what is the investigation revolve around? What questions need to be answered?
Well, we wanted to gather all the text messages or Facebook posts that we could to make sure we had all of them before we complete our investigation. We also wanted to reach out to anybody that was involved complaining, Chelsea, to see if we could get the full picture of what the conversation was. So that's where the investigation was headed towards.
Mm-hmm. What is the status of the detention officer in question right now, Alan Baylock?
He's currently working. I'll tell you, Alan has worked for us since March, and he began as a part-time employee and was recently offered and accepted a full-time position. And he's been working with the inmates, providing security and assistance the whole time. And through his whole tenure there, he has not had any complaints from any inmates or any staff.
Mm-hmm. A young employee?
He is young. He's 20 years old.
Okay.
Just began his career here in Polk County. You know, being a detention officer, that's part of the law enforcement family. And what we see is people coming into law enforcement from the public may not quite grasp the consequences of putting something like that on Facebook or Twitter. When you're in law enforcement, you're held up to a higher standard by the agency as well as by the public. And you should be, because you really have a great responsibility, whether you're a patrol officer or you work in the jail. So our expectations are high. And anytime something like this occurs, if there's anything that would disparage our agency or an officer does something inappropriate, we want to know about it so we can address it and make corrective action.
Mm-hmm. Of course, and as we pointed out earlier, this happens at a time when law enforcement and community relations are really being put to the test and going through some changes here. So a really important time and a very poor time for this to have happened.
It is. The timing could not be worse, but I don't think any time would be okay for this to happen. Nothing excuses this. There's no doubt that there was emotions played in this. It was conveyed by Alan that that there was emotions from the Dallas shootings and what had occurred there. And he did apologize and recognize what he did was inexcusable.
Mm-hmm. Well, given how some of this tension between the public and law enforcement has a lot to do with social media, is your department, your sheriff's office, reviewing how you use social media, how your staff uses it?
We have over 500 employees, and it would be nice. And I don't know that people would feel comfortable if we went and reviewed all our employees' social media. But what we've seen happen is if there is inappropriate conduct on social media, most of the time other employees report it to us, the command staff, so we can address it. In this case, it was both reported from an employee and general public.
Mm-hmm. After the investigation, what are the possible consequences for Detention Officer Baylock?
Well, the range of consequences range from anywhere from ethics sensitivity training all the way up to termination.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Brandon Bracelin, thank you for being so open with us, describing this episode, the investigation here. An officer under investigation after he tweeted to a young woman that she should not call the police if she didn't want to be murdered. Brandon Bracelin, sergeant at the Polk County Sheriff's Office, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
Finally, today on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, this week the Des Moines City Council proposed new regulations for food trucks that would prohibit them from operating after 10:30 in the evening. But after outcry from the Latino community in Des Moines, the city has reached a compromise with taco truck owners. Timothy Mensch is with us, reporter for the Des Moines Register. He's been covering this story. Hi, Tim.
Hey, how are we doing, Ben?
I'm doing well. So give us the background here. What's the problem with these food trucks?
You know, it's a lot of history in the city of Des Moines. They call them transient merchants or transient vendors. They've had an ordinance for a while that's included not just folks selling food, but really anything on city streets. But it's really come to light just 2 years ago, last summer, when they approved food trucks starting to vend on the streets in downtown Des Moines. I'm sure a lot of folks that are listening have, you know, probably seen the food trucks downtown or tried them. It sort of brought this influx and what I would call the next generation of food trucks. We hear about them in the coastal cities, you know, very trendy, kind of hip
exactly.
food. But it's interesting because at the same time, there is almost what I would call maybe the old guard of food trucks that kind of have been here for a lot longer. Some people call them taco trucks, although the city doesn't, you know, legally or formally use that term. But they've been there a lot longer. They aren't very transient in the sense that a lot of them choose one property to sit on, and that's where they locate and they sell their food. But they're covered kind of by the same ordinance, and there's been some changes recently that are kind of changing the rules and the curfew and the time for those vendors outside of the downtown area. But it's a different set of rules than the ones downtown, and so it's triggered, as you said, a little bit of outcry from the Latino community feeling like they've been a little bit targeted because the majority of those owners happen to be, you know, from the Latino community.
When you're outside the downtown, was part of this discussion that went on, I gather, for over 3 hours, part of it is sort of residential areas. Is there a noise or disturbance quality about the complaints here? Or
yeah, that's what city council members are saying. Now, when we say residential areas, I mean, the law on the books for even these taco trucks that are, you know, legally, you know, operating with a permit, they have to be on a commercial or industrial property. They aren't allowed to locate on a residentially zoned property. So think of somewhere maybe like University Avenue or East 14th Street. Those are popular, you know, high traffic corridors with businesses, but maybe they're, you know, the side streets right off there are residential areas. So those are the places where council members have said, hey, we have concerns about these locations. They've said, you know, neighbors have complained about different things. But at the same time with these series of meetings we've had, some of the Latino community have said, we haven't seen the complaints. Show us the complaints. Where are they actually coming from? And those folks haven't really stepped up at the council meetings and made themselves known as far as the residents who live nearby.
And in fact, isn't there concern on some that these policies are aimed at Latinos, that it's sort of an anti-Latino? Would that be going too far?
That's what some have said. You know, council members have mentioned, you know, after staff proposed this ordinance, you know, just to keep things quieter in the neighborhoods and that kind of thing, some council members said that they did not know that this was specifically, you know, targeting Latino community. Some of the reporting that we did showed, you know, that the majority of these owners of these trucks are, or at least the trucks are named, you know, with Mexican, you know, names where they have, you know, specialized in tacos with the vast majority. And some council members said, you know, that was not something they were aware of, that they were just concerned about the neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. So where does it stand now? What was the compromise that was reached?
Yeah, so as you said, there was a five-hour council meeting, which was the longest one that I've seen in my last couple years covering City Hall. The last 3.5 hours of that was taken up with conversation on this. And it did show that City Council really stepped back and they said, we're going to try and listen and hear this out. They brought in a translator, you know, the city who translated kind of sentence by sentence all 3.5 hours of that conversation to hear out the taco truck or food truck owners who were there. And basically, you know, they scaled back some of the preferences that they had. For example, you know, they had mentioned this 10:30 p.m. curfew. They decided that they're going to grandfather in all the trucks that currently are operating and allow them to stay open until 1:30 a.m., which is the same as the downtown trucks. And they said that 10:30 p.m. curfew will only apply basically with new trucks that are starting to apply, and that's only if they're located within 120 feet of a residentially zoned property.
Okay.
So that's one example of the compromise. And there were a couple others where they said, okay, you know, we wanted to have signs for bathrooms, but we're going to take that down. That's not necessary either.
Just a few seconds left. So, Timothy Mensch, you get the idea. Everybody's happy at this point?
Not necessarily. There is talk of a potential lawsuit from some of the Latino advocates who still feel like this isn't exactly what they're looking for. But they're going to come back July 25th with the final reading and final vote at City Council, where I'm sure there'll be more discussion before City Council actually places that vote.
Maybe we'll get an update from you. Thank you, Timothy Mensch, reporter for the Des Moines Register on the Des Moines Taco Truck. I guess we're calling them food trucks officially, right, Timothy?
That's right.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up on Monday on this program, even before the Declaration of Independence was signed, our founding fathers established the post office. On Monday's program, I talk with Winifred Gallagher, author of How the Post Office Created America. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth, with help from Lauren Knutson. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.